Mr. Charlotte Talks, I'm Mike Collins. News centering on our environment is both good and bad. Global warming is getting worse, and during this hottest stretch of the summer, you may not be surprised to find that the world has been 2 degrees hotter this year than what we experienced in all of the 20th century. Here in North Carolina, we haven't had the monster storms with flooding or the raging fires of the West, which stem from climate change, but the southwestern part of the state is now experiencing drought again. So where's the good news? Our air quality is getting better, and with much less particulate matter in the air, visibility is improving, which means much better views in our mountains. That just scratches the surface. This hour, we'll dig a little deeper with three environmental reporters to help us cover a wide variety of topics from the air we breathe to the way we generate electric power. David Borax is WFAE's environmental reporter. He joins us here in our studio with Bruce Henderson, environmental reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And with us from the studios of Public Radio's WUNC in Durham is Dave DeWitt, former environmental reporter there, now the station's managing editor. Congratulations and welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Let's start with Duke Energy's coal ash ponds. It was reported recently that according to J.D. Power, which is the company that rates all these other companies around the country periodically, Duke Energy, again, ranks at the bottom among large electric utilities in the South in residential customer satisfaction ratings. And J.D. Power says this can be attributed to the lingering effects of the 2014 coal ash spill into the Dan River. Bruce, that ranking comes in spite of relatively low electric power charges that Duke charges their customer compared to other utilities, and it's in spite of its dependability. Evidently, we have dependable power here on a regular basis. Does news like this have any effect on Duke Energy's approach to cleaning up those coal ash storage facilities, or they just don't doing what they're doing?
I think they're doing what they're doing. They're doing what the state tells them to do in part, too. J.D. Power, who I talked to for this story, said they think there is sort of a hangover effect from the coal ash public image hit that Duke took 2.5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. That's a long time ago. People still remember that. He says it'll go away. But for Duke Energy Carolinas, which services the Charlotte area and which owns the power plant that spilled that ash, there is still that lingering effect that people still have in their minds. It is a public perception thing. He did go on to say that Duke, these rankings are for large utilities in the South, and that is a tough group. They're high performers like the Southern Company and some others. And he said Duke has some tough competition in that particular region, which drove their relative rankings down a little bit.
Most people are probably aware of J.D. Power, if they're aware of them at all, because they put their seal of approval or they give rankings to car manufacturers and how dependable cars are and things like that. And the car manufacturers who come out ahead always tout, well, J.D. Power says that, blah, blah, blah. This is a monopoly.
It's a regulated monopoly, yeah. Duke is always quick to say.
So who pays for J.D. Power to take these surveys in this case?
I don't know. I know that the companies that participate, so quote-unquote, do get the particulars of the ratings. They get more details about why the ratings were what they were, and they get information on the different parameters that J.D. Power measures in their rankings. So it's helpful to the companies. And Duke has said that we learn from what J.D. Power tells us. So they do take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Duke's been increasing its use of other fuels to generate electricity, more natural gas. Wind power is coming online. Some solar is already online. Has that been able to lower in any meaningful way the coal ash that they're adding to these storage facilities they've been building up over time?
The quick answer is that they are using less coal, so they are putting less into the landfills. They still have this problem of cleaning up the coal ash that's built up throughout the 20th century and the early part of the 21st century here. So these landfills are, you know, chock full of 100 million plus tons of coal ash, and they're under court orders or state law to remove it from about half the sites, and they're in the process of determining what to do in the other half.
So. We've done a lot of programs on coal ash and coal ash removal and what to do with these things, particularly in light of the Dan River spill, and it seems to be a moving target. When we get a handle on it, something changes about it. So where does all of this stand right now? Or is that even a question that can be answered?
Oh, it can be answered, I think. The state legislature weighed in, as we know, a few weeks ago. and probably made Duke happy in saying that you don't have to close all these ponds down and move the ash out. That's critical because there's so much material. It is a multi-billion-dollar undertaking, a multi-decadal undertaking. And so the legislature said for the remaining, most of the remaining ash pits, you don't have to take the coal ash away. That's critical for Duke. It did say you'll also have to provide alternative water to people who live around your coal ash sites. Mm-hmm. That's good for the neighborhoods there, even though it can take a while.
They did say to Duke, you've got to fix the problems with these sites, though. In some cases, they're leaking. The dams around these coal ash ponds aren't that good. So there is a requirement that they fix these up and get them to a point where the state says they look okay and we think they can last for a while. They have taken reporters like us on tours of some of these sites, and the amount of coal ash is really amazing. It's a large amount. And I don't know if they did it in the eastern part of the state with you, Dave, but they took us to Marshall Steam Station on Lake Norman, and it's like mountains out there.
Yeah, we all went to the Dan River site, obviously, and that was a huge facility as well. But one of the things that, you know, we talk about how things keep moving in this story, but the one constant really from the beginning is that no matter what happens with this, the cost to Duke Energy of whatever they end up doing with the coal ash is going to be passed on to customers. That has been stated pretty unequivocally from the company itself, from legislators, from anyone else who was on the original Coal Ash Management Commission, which is now defunct. So, you know, if people out there who don't want to sort of pay attention to all of the different twists and turns, know that at some point it's going to show up on your electric bill.
Hmm. At one point, early in these discussions about coal ash, we discovered that the EPA had never classified coal ash as being a toxic substance. Has that changed?
It has not changed.
And yet... It's clear that if it's in your drinking water, it's not good for you. So why have they not classified it as a toxic substance?
There are a lot of things that are not good for you. You know, a toxicologist, Mike, would say that the dose is the poison is in the dose. It's the concentration and the period of years that you're exposed to this, yeah, and how you're exposed to it as well. What we have to remember about coal ash is that it has contaminated groundwater at every single power plant Duke owns in North Carolina. You can't just turn that off like a spigot. It doesn't work that way. So whether they remove the ash or not, whether they fix up the dams or not, you still have contaminated groundwater. And that's the thing that's going to have to be watched for many decades because it moves.
And at one point, we were told that well water, I think it was, which is obviously groundwater, in certain areas was okay to drink. And then suddenly it wasn't okay to drink.
That is a whole political controversy in itself, I think. But a year ago, state health officials said your water's not safe to drink. And then some months later, there was an announcement that, well, actually, it's okay to drink. And those actually came from two different sources, those rulings. And, you know, I think there is some question about how the first one came about, how the second one came about. You know, it doesn't look good. The bottom line, as Bruce says, is that the groundwater is contaminated there, and it does get into anybody who's using a natural well in those places. And
so you went out to the Riverbend station, David, and it's hard to visualize, as I would imagine, and I've never been, but in all the conversations we've had on this program about this, with Duke Energy saying, you know, if you lined up trucks and you filled dump trucks up with this coal ash and you just kept doing it, this will go on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for decades to get rid of all this coal ash. That's what we're talking about here. So you went out there. They've been storing coal ash at Riverbend since 1929. That's a long time. 5 million tons. They closed that plant in 2013, and one of the things they did there was to store that ash in a wet state so that it wouldn't blow away in the wind. And you reported that's how coal ash pond water made its way into Mountain Island Lake, which is, of course, the body of water from which Charlotte takes its drinking water. Is that still happening?
Is the water flowing into?
Yes. Is coal ash contamination still flowing into the water from the water that stored, that keeps the coal ash wet?
Well, they're in the process right now of draining those ponds. So this one may not be an example of something that's ongoing. I actually have not checked into the situation there in the last couple of months since I was out there. But, of course, we did have an incident recently where, as part of the process of closing down those coal ash ponds, they began draining some of the surface water off of one of the ponds, and that actually put arsenic into the lake, and that raised the arsenic levels, and Duke discovered it pretty quickly, and the Mecklenburg County discovered it pretty quickly, and they shut down that discharge, and so then they waited until they had a water treatment plant online that could take some of those contaminants out. But, you know, at every one of these locations, there is either there have been leaks or there are ongoing concerns about water getting into the water table and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's why we are in this situation. That's why we're doing this. We've got to have a new way to store this.
And Riverbend is just one of, I think, 30 coal ash storage locations scattered around North Carolina. 5 million tons in the Riverbend station alone. And they're trying to empty these coal ash disposal sites and move the coal ash to various different places, to lined pits, to clay mines, and things like that. How is that any better from what they're doing right now? Dave in Durham.
Well, it is better. I mean, the Southern Environmental Law Center, which keeps very close ties on this thing, they're very much behind moving these facilities away from the rivers. And that's the other thing that's important to know, that all of these facilities, because of where you needed to build coal plants, are on rivers. So if you were going to reverse engineer these things, you would never put coal ash pits near rivers because it's so simple for it to break through a rusty corrugated pipe and into the Dan River. So moving these things away from the rivers and back out into other areas, into lined landfills, appeals to some people. It doesn't appeal to the people who live near these places where the lined landfills might be. Up here in the middle part of the state, there are a couple of abandoned clay mines that they're starting to move coal ash to. And obviously folks in that area are very disappointed that that's occurring and fought it pretty mightily. And some of the ash from the Dan River sites moving into Virginia, some of the ash in South Carolina, and they're moving ash a lot faster, is moving into other places outside of their state. So, you know, nobody wants this stuff. But it really has to get away from unlined pits near rivers. Almost everyone agrees with that.
Clay is said to be a natural barrier to seepage from coal ash. And yet, as you mentioned, it's very controversial in areas where they want to put this coal ash disposal because they're still worried about seepage. Is that a legitimate concern?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, they're talking about in Chatham and Lee counties, even though they're abandoned coal or clay mines, they're going to line them. And we've seen these demonstrations of what the liners look like and then what the water catchment system underneath those liners looks like. And they'd end up looking like tall hills of coal ash covered with soil. So if you drove by it, you wouldn't see mounds of coal ash. But if you live nearby one of these things, all you've heard for the past couple of years is right. Coal ash is getting into water and it's going to make you sick. And now it's coming to your community. So obviously those folks, no matter what kind of liner it looks like and whether the clay works like a natural barrier is not making those folks feel any better.
What are these liners made of?
They're a plastic liner, basically.
But plastic doesn't last forever.
Maybe a few hundred years. Yeah.
Yeah. And then what?
Oh, I think a few hundred years is maybe a stretch, maybe 30 years.
Mm-hmm. So are we just kicking the can down the road?
We are, and there's no, you know, raise your hand if you have a better idea.
How about cement?
Actually, it's funny you should mention that. One of the things that the law that was signed this spring by the governor requires is beneficial reuse, and the main thing is to include it in concrete. It depends on the quality, what kind of chemicals are in the coal ash. If there's too much contaminants, they can't use it.
We'll talk more about coal ash disposal and many other things in our environmental conversation today with Dave DeWitt from WUNC, David Borax from WFAE, and Bruce Henderson from the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally, Summer of 69 No Apostrophe Tour, August 10th at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available at livenation.com. Well, schools aren't yet in session, but education has not slowed down for the summer. The debate over student assignment here is set to heat up as CMS prepares to begin a series of public meetings next week. The school board has set a goal of selecting a new superintendent by the end of the year. School suspensions have been under scrutiny, while teacher pay is improving. We're going to talk about all of this and more with two reporters who follow education in this area every single day. We'll do that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, now that they're the official presidential nominees, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are revving up their general election campaigns. A look at Democratic and Republican strategies, the electoral map, and what to expect in the weeks ahead.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to David Borax from WFAE News, Bruce Henderson from the Charlotte Observer, and David DeWitt from WUNC, all environmental reporters. Dave has moved up the ladder now to become the managing editor of WUNC, but he's slumming for us today to talk about the environment. And we're talking about coal ash at the moment. We will move on to other things. In April, a Superior Court judge in Raleigh ordered Duke Industry Energy to remove coal ash from three plants in eastern North Carolina. In July, Governor McCrory signed a bill allowing Duke Energy to store coal ash in place permanently at as many as half of its plants in the state. Help me out here. Is there a conflict here? Is one countermanding the other?
I think, and bear with me because I'm old and because there's so many parts to this, there's legal issues, there's legislation, there are lawsuits, all these things. I think in that case, Duke had reached an agreement to remove the ash, as I'm remembering, David, and said that they were basically okay with that idea of taking it out.
So I actually had an hour-long conversation with somebody who's involved in some of these lawsuits on the environmental side, and I said, can you help me out here? And it took an hour for him to go through all of the different lawsuits. But basically, the way it is going to work out is the courts are going to take precedence here. So if a court says it has to be removed instead of being capped in place, then they're going to have to remove it.
And that's April, and the bill came into place in July.
And so the bill doesn't disagree with the with the legal cases so far. But essentially, the way it works out is right now, the court cases and the state law that require removal are all talking about the same seven plants.
Yeah.
And the seven that are left that have not been ruled on in a court yet that are the subject of the state legislation, those are the ones that Duke has some leeway now to decide, do we remove it or do we leave it where it is? Now, there are still some court cases working their way through the courts here, and we may yet see additional court orders that whittle that, you know, number of sites that can be left in place down to a smaller number.
The bill that the governor signed also provides for water, and you mentioned this earlier, David, to be supplied permanently to neighbors of these coal ash ponds. And they say that this bill and that solution, quote, protects customers by allowing for less expensive methods of closing coal ash ponds that won't find their way onto your electric bill. How big a concern is that for people? Would they rather have higher bills and less pollution in their water, or vice versa?
You know, as Dave DeWitt said earlier, this Duke has said, you know, we're going to ask for a rate increase for the costs of this. And so looking at it not from a strict environmental standpoint, but from an economic standpoint, there's a lot of people in North Carolina that probably don't want to see their bills go up by 25, 30%. 50%, which, you know, if the full cost of this was borne by the ratepayers, that's what it could be. You know, it's also, I think the Utilities Commission would have to weigh any expenses that Duke was trying to recover through that process. And I'm not sure what the rate increase will ultimately be, but they have to decide if it's, you know, is it something that ratepayers can bear.
When we were talking about plastic liners a second ago, that they were talking about putting in these new pits where they move the coal ash to, and the plastic liner has a lifespan of possibly 30 years, certainly not very many more than 30 years. Seems like that's something you're going to have to keep doing over and over and over again because the thing's going to deteriorate. And I mentioned concrete. That's one of the products that you can use coal ash in because it encapsulates the coal ash and protects the environment. How many other products are there that can incorporate coal ash? And is there simply too much coal ash around the country to viably use all of it in the manufacture of these products?
That's what Duke Energy would tell you, that there is. They have more coal ash than can be easily converted into concrete. The concrete industry differs on that. They say we have to import the stuff from South Carolina and other places to make concrete. Coal ash is a great product because it makes concrete stiffer, tougher, more durable. It's a good ingredient.
And it doesn't leach out of the bad stuff. Doesn't leach out of the concrete.
That's right. You're binding it up. It's inert.
So
at that point.
If concrete companies are having to import this stuff from South Carolina and there's a market for it, why doesn't Duke provide that market?
Because they know it's cheaper to do it with it, what they're doing now, than it is to sell it. If they thought they could make money on selling coal ash, I guarantee you Duke Energy would be selling coal ash.
And they have their ashes.
Excuse me, but why is South Carolina selling it?
Don't have as much.
They don't have as much. The scale between the ash in South Carolina and between the scale in North Carolina is like a factor of 10. We have way more ash than they do.
Is that why they're ahead of us in this? Because when we talked about this months and months ago, maybe a year ago, South Carolina came up in that conversation, and they seem to be way ahead of North Carolina in handling this problem. Is that because they simply don't have as much of the stuff as we do?
That's part of it, but they also developed a sort of a closed-loop system down there. There is a company in South Carolina that takes the stuff and converts it into a usable form for concrete. And so there's less ash. They have a company there that can make it concrete ready, if you will. And in North Carolina, Duke's ash has too much carbon in it to be used to make concrete. You can take the carbon out, but that means building a new facility with a larger process. Duke has sort of thought about that, but hasn't pushed the button on going ahead with that. And so they're at loggerheads with the concrete industry right now.
Let's move on to something different. Let's move on to clean energy. Conservatives for Clean Energy, that's an organization, commissioned a poll which found widespread support in this state for renewable energy and energy efficiency across all partisan and ideological lines. North Carolina voters said they would vote for legislators and elected officials who are working to expand these energy innovations. Has that message gotten through to legislators in North Carolina, Dave DeWitt?
No, probably not. I mean, I think because, the environment this year will be an interesting political topic. Typically, environmental issues are down the list of things that people vote on. There is education. The economy is obviously number one. The environment may be moving up a little bit on that list for various reasons, mostly the Dan River coal ash spill. But there's still a very small percentage of North Carolinians who vote based on their legislators' potential economic or environmental views. And I think legislators know this. That said, it certainly is a topic of conversation and above the fold headlines, if you will. And legislators understand this. And so, you'll see some of this. You'll see it come up in the debates, I'm sure, between Governor McCrory and Roy Cooper. Roy Cooper will try to paint Governor McCrory as a former employee of Duke Energy, protecting the company now, and the governor will probably fight back against that. But beyond that, I don't think you'll see it being a huge issue when it comes November election time.
In 2007, this state became the first state in the Southeast. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. And the 25th in the nation to adopt a renewable energy and energy efficiency portfolio standard. Support for that law crosses ideological boundaries. Legislators, though, allowed the state's renewable energy investment debt credit to expire at the end of last year. And yet, 72.1% of voters support reestablishing that credit. How much impact did that tax credit have? And is there any possibility that they'll reinstate it come the next session in 2017?
The tax credit was helpful, but not critical. The 2007 legislation that you referred to was more important in that it established a market. It gave a solar developer a place to sell their electricity, so the utilities had to buy it, right. And that was critical. And so you've, through that, spawned an industry that created thousands of jobs. And for a lot of legislatures are aware of that, and that's why they would back it. The tax credit is important, but there's also federal tax credits that are also important, and so those are still exist.
It's also true, though, that especially with solar power, it's sort of making an argument for itself now. I mean, I think a lot of consumers are interested in this. I mean, you mentioned polls and all that sort of thing. There's definitely a demand out there, at least among a certain segment of the population, to do this. And But I think a lot of people no longer need to be sold with a tax credit. I think they're just interested in doing it. And that, you know, they're going to look at the economics of it and how long it'll take to pay off the investment for those panels on their roof. But I do think there's demand.
But the tax credit helps in that.
It helps for sure. But, you know, solar prices have come down so fast in the last 5 years, faster than anybody expected, that solar, you could make the argument, can stand on its own feet at this point. It's an established thing. The installed price of solar is very close to that of traditional means of electric generation, and that's a good thing for the industry. And so you could say, well, you don't really need to support it anymore with tax credits and things of that nature.
Meanwhile,
and we should say the vast majority of solar growth is in these large-scale industrial solar complexes, not sort of the rooftop solar, and there's still some things in place. There's no third-party sales allowed in North Carolina. There's no net metering, and that has really hampered sort of that residential solar panels on your roof market.
Public support for offshore drilling for oil and gas, for nuclear energy, and for fracking are significantly lower than support for development of renewable energy options like wind or solar and for additional ways to finance energy efficiency upgrades. Is that message being heard in Raleigh?
I don't think so. You know, I think it's the utility is not a company. It's not a startup company that can move quickly. And companies like Duke, they plan, you know, years, decades in advance. And, you know, quick changes in the industry like we're seeing with renewable energy are hard for Duke to absorb quickly. You know, they are doing some of this. They do have this target of hitting, you know, a certain percentage of their energy production from renewable sources by 2020, but it's not going to happen as fast as some people would like it to happen.
Without opening the state to fracking, without opening our offshore areas to drilling, can Duke Energy keep up with the demand for electric power generation in the years to come? Or do we need that kind of stuff in addition to wind and solar and the traditional forms of power generation?
You know, Duke is in transition from mostly coal plants to now they're putting a big emphasis on natural gas. And natural gas is a lot cheaper, so that's one of the incentives. It's an economic incentive. There's also the regulations
about coal.
That
comes from fracking. You can get natural
gas
from fracking.
So I was going to say our state is already open to fracking in a sense that some of the natural gas that Duke uses is from fracking sources now. Nuclear power is still a big part of the energy mix in North Carolina as well, and Duke would like to do more of that. They've got plans on the drawing board for a couple of nuclear power plants in South Carolina and North Carolina. The government policies have not made a full shift yet to allowing that. We don't know what's going to happen with those licenses.
Well, just when the appetite for nuclear power was beginning to build back to a positive point on the scale, we had that situation in Japan.
Fukushima ruined it.
Yeah, and it ruined everything. So and I don't know how people feel about the nuclear power, but is there an appetite for more nuclear in North Carolina, David? DeWitt?
Among some people, for sure. You'd mentioned the Conservatives for Clean Energy group. That's a group that considers nuclear clean energy. There's other groups, environmental groups, that don't consider it clean energy, that you still have to do something with the waste. At some of the nuclear plants I've visited, you can look right down into their ponds, and they've got nuclear waste right sitting right there, rods that have been spent, and they've got to store it right on that facility. That was never the intent, but now it's something that has to happen because you don't want to put it on trains and trucks and move it around all over the country. So, you know, that's a point of contention. Is nuclear power, something that's renewable and clean? And I want to go back to something you mentioned about what was heard in Raleigh and offshore oil. One of the interesting things, you know, a lot of times things aren't heard in Raleigh, but the offshore oil fight was heard in Raleigh because of all of the communities up and down the coast of North Carolina that passed resolutions against offshore oil. These are largely conservative Republican areas. Mm-hmm. They let their state legislators hear about the issues that they had. Governor McCrory backed it very strongly. The federal government reversed itself and decided not to pursue it. But that lingering political fight will be interesting to watch because there's a lot of folks who are disappointed in Governor McCrory and their Republican legislators who live along the coast of North Carolina.
You reported, Dave, last year on wind farms in the eastern part of the state and on at least one company that pays farmers to use their land for their wind turbines. And Amazon is purchasing all of the power from that farm, I understand. How's that project working out?
It's working. Believe it or not, it's actually on time. Their construction is going on right now. They've got some of the turbines are up and in the air. This is an area of the state that's really interesting. It's called the desert. It's east of sort of Elizabeth, or pardon me, west of Elizabeth City. It's, you know, drained swamps. Now it's, you know, agricultural land, pretty treeless, very flat. Great place for these kind of wind farms. It's an area of the state also that's served by Dominion Power and not by Duke Energy. And a lot of people cite that might be a reason why this large wind farm, the first in North Carolina and the southeast, has been allowed to be built. Governor McCrory had to step in at the last minute to sort of allow the process to get through his administration, the regulation aspect of that. All of the energy that comes out of this will go to Amazon, as you mentioned, and it won't be going to North Carolina residents or Virginia residents, for that matter, to one of their facilities. And it's really, I don't want to say a PR campaign, but it allows Amazon to say to its customers, look, we believe in clean energy. We believe in climate change. This is something we're doing to power our facilities. So in that regard, it's still sort of a pilot project, but it's a pretty large pilot project. And a lot of the farmers really like it because it's a source of rental income for them.
About $54,000 a year, I understand, per farmer.
Yeah, depending on the size and how many of them you have on your property.
Back up for a second. You mentioned that this is a part of the state that's served by Dominion Power, which is the power company from Virginia. It used to be called VEPCO, Virginia Electric Power Company. And you said that it was allowed to be built there because Dominion serves that part of North Carolina, not Duke Energy. Are you saying that if Duke Energy served that part of North Carolina, there would have been some roadblocks put up to stop this from happening?
I would say that Duke Energy has not been as aggressive in this state in wind energy. There are parts of the state offshore that Duke Energy could look at potentially putting some wind farms, but they don't have that much of an interest in it because a lot of their customers don't live within an area that is easily served by that. So I think that's probably true. Dominion had proposed putting an offshore wind farm off the coast of Virginia. So that just as a company, it's a little more interested in wind energy as a potential source of electricity, and at least in this state or in the southeast.
Geographically speaking, North Carolina is in, I'm told, we're in the ideal position for wind power in the entire Atlantic seaboard, and yet we don't use it. Why not?
Right. Well, because I think it's a lot of the viewscape issues that we saw in the mountains a few years ago. There, you know, the mountains of North Carolina are also a great area for wind farms, but that's never going to happen because of the viewscapes issue. That's certainly the case for the tourism industry as well off the coast of North Carolina. The tourism industry is one of the most powerful lobbies in the state.
But we talked to some scientists about this a couple of years ago, and they said that in the shore locations, you would not be able to see the wind turbines from the shore.
And that is true. Under the current proposal, under the Obama administration for offshore wind, which, as Dave mentioned, Duke Energy has little interest in, but under that proposal, the wind turbines would have to be offshore enough that you couldn't see them. And a lot of coastal communities wanted to make that so, that they don't want to see those things on the horizon.
We'll take a break. We'll come back and wrap up our wind power, solar power conversation and talk about environmental policy in the state of North Carolina and what that's doing to drive the environmental aspect of all of this. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Over 75 clinicians making more than 85,000 home visits annually, providing comprehensive primary care to patients in their home, workplace, or senior community. Information and registration at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Well, now that they are the official presidential nominees, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are revving up their general election campaigns. Guest host Susan Page will be in for Diane Rehm in 20 minutes. At 10 o'clock with a panel of guests to talk about Democratic and Republican strategies, the electoral map, and what to expect in the remaining weeks ahead. Less than 100 days left to go till the November election, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it. Email us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
After surviving a brief but bloody coup attempt, Turkey's president has announced a state of emergency.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
In announcing Charlotte had lost the All-Star game, the NBA stated, "While we recognize the NBA cannot choose the law."
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dave DeWitt, former environmental reporter, now managing editor of WUNC in Chapel Hill, the public radio station up there. Bruce Henderson, environmental reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and David Borax, environmental reporter here at WFAE, about the environment and about what's going on with power and environmental policy this summer. At the opening of the first phase of that wind power farm that we talked about earlier that's going to be selling all of its power to Amazon, Governor McCrory called it continued proof that North Carolina is going to continue to participate in our country's energy independence. But since that time, hasn't the state made it more difficult to build both wind and solar farms in the state of North Carolina? Haven't they mandated like mile wide setbacks for these facilities?
There is legislation on the table that did not pass this past session that would restrict wind farms. In particular, it would protect military airspace.
Mm-hmm.
And if you the maps that were produced as part of that legislation show the military airspace somehow covering most of North Carolina. And what I read but did not report directly was that the military wasn't consulted on that. And that they basically have already weighed in about what protected areas should be, which were far smaller in area.
How tall are these wind turbines?
The Amazon.com farm that you talked about, they're the tallest turbines, if you count it when the turbine is pointing straight up, is 492 feet. It's pretty tall.
How tall is an average skyscraper in downtown Charlotte?
I mean, that's as tall as some skyscrapers in downtown Charlotte.
And yet we have them.
We do. You know, that law that Bruce is referring to was called the Military Facilities Protection Act of 2016. Sounds laudable and something we could all get behind. But I think that the idea of protecting the airspace was just an excuse to oppose the wind power. There is a lobby out there that doesn't want to see us adopt wind power or other renewable energy. And I don't know if they are big supporters of the existing large utilities or what, but there's an ideological opposition to renewable energy that it's a little hard to explain. I guess, I would love it if somebody would tell me why this happens.
Well, a lot of the legislators that tend to produce this legislation tend to come from rural areas where they have the backing of farmers. You know, it's interesting, this conversation that goes on in rural areas. We talked about a farmer getting benefit from some of these facilities, whether they're solar or wind. But there are a lot of farmers who don't like it because they believe it takes agricultural land out of commission for growing things for 30, 50, sometimes 100 years. And so this ideological divide conversation is going on in these rural communities, and you hear a lot of it and you see a lot of it even in the legislature itself, different legislators representing these areas arguing on the floor.
But don't they have arable land around the solar arrays and around these turbines that they can actually plant crops?
Sure they do. Around turbines they could. And on solar farms, they have a 20-year life. And the farmer or the landowner is leasing the site. When the 20 years is up, he can take the things out and farm again if he wants to. Plus which, nobody is holding a gun to the heads of these landowners to sign these leases. They don't have to sell. If the land had a higher economic value as farmland, I would think that those property owners would farm instead of sign leases for solar farms.
And it can still be grazing land, and in some cases, especially around the wind turbines, it can still produce agricultural products. So
a company in Charlotte has sheep grazing around their solar farms. O2 Energies in Cornelius has sheep grazing around solar farms,
which keeps the grass cut essentially. Yeah, around the arrays. Last week, the Southern Environmental Law Center issued a report entitled "Dismantled" that they say demonstrates a trend by state officials to undermine sensible environmental policies by cutting state agency funding, banning certain environmental protections, and by prioritizing short-term gains for special interests over long-term planning to benefit all of North Carolina. That's some of the things we've been talking about so far today. They pointed to the attempt by the state to outlaw the study of sea level rise, giving seats on state environmental boards held by scientists to industry and political appointees, the recently passed law allowing Duke Energy to leave coal ash in place, among other things. Is this what's really happening? And if so, what is the legislative justification for it?
You know, the Southern Environmental Law Center's report was really just a catalog of all these things that have happened over the last few years. And, you know, if you have an environmental perspective, this is the way you see it. And I think a lot of people see it that way as well. You know, it's describing the political situation at the State House in Raleigh right now. And I'm not sure there's more to it.
I mean, are they putting political appointees as opposed to scientists on boards that rule on environmental policy?
They are.
We had last week Mike Stan Riggs, who is a eminent geologist at East Carolina University, resigned from the state science panel on coastal issues, including sea level rise. In disgust, he thinks that what's happening, what you describe, is happening, mm-hmm. and that things are shifting so far away from science that he couldn't serve on that panel anymore. So I think that sort of underscores where he thinks it's going.
In fact, he said our leadership decided that the public shouldn't know too much science.
Well, there was a famous legislation from a few years ago that basically outlawed sea level rise in North Carolina. It said that we're not going to look into the future 100 years as the science panel had been asked to do. That is crazy. But when you talk to the people who were behind that, they said, well, it's really going to kill economic development down here. And they were very transparent about that. If you tell people that sea level is going to be 3 feet or 6 feet higher in 100 years than it is now, people are not going to build on that property. And that was their motive and incentive for doing that.
But if you're right, and you're, of course, nobody builds for that long anymore, but if you're right and you put a house down there or an apartment or a condo development down there or big hotels down there, and in 100 years or by 2100, I guess that's less than 100 years, you're 3 feet underwater, is that a good investment?
You know, you would think people would look at it that way. But I think a lot of people, they want their beach house, or they want, you know, a developer wants to put up a new hotel there. And there's a strong drive. I actually interviewed both Stan Riggs and the head of the Coastal Resources Commission. And they are so far apart in their views that, you know, it's a classic example of the polarity in our political system right now. But
is this a matter of that the Democrats pointed to in their convention that we don't believe science? We have our own beliefs, and science is just an opinion.
Well, you know, in my interview with the head of the Coastal Resources Commission, he was coming at it from a business perspective. Now, he was appointed by Governor Pat McCrory 3 years ago. And one of the arguments here between Stan Riggs and his colleagues there was that Stan was arguing for a longer view, a 100-year view. They ended up with a 30-year view. And the argument from those folks is, look, business people don't plan any more than 30 years out. There's a mortgage is 30 years. That's our planning horizon is 30 years. And mm-hmm. so we shouldn't have to look farther out than that. And, you know, obviously there are other people out there who think we should be looking what the end result of things is, however far in the future that is. And, you know, there really are two different views of it. And it's playing out all up and down the Carolina coast and South Carolina right now with development issues. But Bruce was talking about the legislation. Not only did they, changed the number of years you could look out, but they also told cities and towns around the state that you can't adopt regulations setting your own estimates of what sea level rise is if you're planning to use it for regulation. So, you know, it's just not allowed anymore.
Getting back to that Southern Environmental Law Center report that came out last week called Dismantled, it also points to a bill that repealed air quality protections. In 2015, the report says the General Assembly legislated a dramatic reduction in the number of air quality monitors in North Carolina. This came soon after the passage of a bill that limited citizens' rights to protest air pollution permits. And yet, Bruce, you reported last week that the state's mountains and skylines are emerging from the haze that we've experienced the last several years, thanks to clean air rules. Are those federal rules or North Carolina rules or a little of both?
They are a little of both. The seminal law was passed in 2002 called the Clean Smokestacks Act. It's hard to imagine it being passed now, but it said coal-powered power plants owned by the largest utility in the state, Duke Energy, have to reduce their emissions sharply. This was a multi-billion dollar demand by the state on the utility. That's why it's hard to imagine happening now. But the result took a few years. Duke did install, did agree to the law, didn't fight it, did slap on scrubbers and precipitators and other things to catch pollutants. And this is the payoff that you get after 15 to 20 years, you can markedly and measurably see cleaner air.
And you reported that in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, average visibility on clear days rose from 54 miles in 1996 to 89 miles in 2014. Obviously, that has an impact on visibility, and it also affects downtown Charlotte because we can see the skyscrapers without a haze. Does that increase tourist dollars into the state? Because of the Great Smoky Mountains?
I wouldn't think so. Most people go to the mountains, and if it looks gauzy and hazy, they say, well, that's why they call them the Smoky Mountains. Well, no, but I don't think most tourists would notice that. I can notice it from my 12th floor office, though. I can see Crowder's Mountain on most days this summer, which is maybe 20, 25 miles south of us, and I don't think that would have been true 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Let me share some emails that have come in while we've been talking. Tony says, this may sound like a silly question, but human beings are good at technology when it comes to making money. What happens when we get so good at capturing the air and energy that we begin to significantly inhibit the flow of air currents? No way. I think we're projecting too far into the future, Tony. Jason writes, we keep hearing that Duke Energy is or is not in favor of this or that. With a governor who worked his entire career with Duke Energy, a General Assembly that kowtows to Duke Energy, and serious issues confronting our state and planet that transcend the need for the cheapest power possible, have we reached a point in time that we should begin reconsidering our energy production and distribution model? To be clear, our current model is that a profit-driven, shareholder-owned monopoly enjoys nearly complete control, with apologies to the North Carolina Utilities Commission, of our state's energy policy.
I keep getting that question as well, Mike. People just can't get over the fact that Duke is a regulated monopoly. It's a regulated state, as are most states. And maybe it is time to revisit that question, especially with the growth of renewables where people want to put solar panels on their rooftops and kind of do it on their own. Maybe it is time to revisit some sort of decoupling where profits wouldn't be driven to electric sales. But that's a big undertaking, and deregulation has not fared wonderfully well in the states that have tried that. In fact, Duke Energy sold some power plants in the Midwest that were commercial plants that were not regulated in the sense that the ones here are. And because the revenue swings were too much for Duke to handle, they were up and down and just unstable. And so Duke divested of those power plants. So it's not a panacea to go away from the system that we have here, but it may be worth revisiting.
And what are you hearing up in – we live in the hometown of Duke Energy, Dave DeWitt, but you live near the centers of political power. What are you hearing up there about this?
I mean, there's no chance in the next, you know, foreseeable future that they're going to deregulate the monopoly that Duke Energy enjoys. But what's interesting to me about it, and you hear this conversation a little bit around Raleigh, is that the energy business kind of cruised along for decades. There's not major change, and you know, there might be a little change here in where you get your sources of power and all that. But now, all of a sudden, in the last 5 or 6 years, you've seen major technological changes in the energy business. And this is not a company, Duke Energy, that is typically used to moving quickly on things. They are the largest solar owner in this state because they see that as being a potential market they need to get on top of. They're trying to do everything right now so that they can be covered when if something breaks out here or something breaks out there, they can be on top of it. But it's a company with a lot of employees, a lot of influence, obviously, in Raleigh. There are a lot of different opinions on even within the company on how they should do things. And certainly in Raleigh, the opinions are a little bit more conservative. And I don't think you'll see any change to how the legislature and the governor interact with Duke Energy dramatically anytime in the next few years.
Only have a couple
barring minutes. Election results.
Only have a couple minutes left. I want to touch on the drought. We talked about sea level rise, which may actually be rising faster than anticipated because every year we seem to have warmer years than ever before. And last year was the warmest year on record. The first 6 months of this year have been 2 degrees higher than anything in recorded history. We have fires in the west and a terrible flood yesterday in Maryland from these ridiculously strong the thunderstorms that we never used to have in the past. And now we have a drought back again in the western part of North Carolina. Is that caused by the warming climate, or is it just one of those things?
Scientists would say quickly you can't isolate any particular meteorological event and say that it's climate change. What you can say, though, is this what is probably what the future looks like, where you've got more extremes, you've got more frequent droughts, longer lasting droughts, you've got more torrential downpours. The extremes are magnified under climate change, and that's what we're seeing. So it's to say it is climate change is hard, but to say that it's consistent with what we think climate change will look like is easier.
Over the weekend, the U.S. National Whitewater Center dumped its water. It was found to have an amoeba in it that killed a young girl. And they chlorinated, superchlorinated the water, dechlorinated the water, and released it into the Catawba River. Can we be assured that it's safe?
The Whitewater Center?
That the water released into the Catawba is safe.
It's 99.9% clear, I think. And, the other thing to remember is that there are amoeba in the Catawba River already. So, that's going to be a fact of nature.
Okay. And that's a story we need to keep our eye on because obviously that's a tourist attraction in North Carolina and they've kind of been out of business for about a month. David Borax, environmental reporter from WFAE News, Bruce Henderson, environmental reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Dave DeWitt, former environmental reporter and now managing editor at WUNC in Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh. It's a tri-county area there. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.